Hello, it is Wednesday, July 15th. Welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Andrew Jung. The Korean Confederation of Trade Union launched a general strike and held a massive rally in Seoul demanding direct wage negotiations between employers and subcontracted workers. More on that in today's news briefing. In other headlines, South Korean President Lee Jae-myung has asked financial authorities to cushion the volatility resulting from single stock leveraged ETFs. In our in-depth news analysis segment, we invite two experts to discuss government's proposed merger of South Korea's three military academies into a single institution. Plus, in our weekly Korea Book Club segment, we discuss a rather bloody book with a deep, tragic plot. Korea 24 starts now. Major umbrella labor union launched a general strike and held a massive rally in Seoul on Wednesday. Mobilizing an estimated 10,000 members, the union demanded that prime contractors engage in direct negotiations with subcontracted workers. For more on the rally and other major headlines of the day, we have in the studio with us Deputy Editor-in-Chief of KBS World's English News Service, Kim In-kyung. Hello, In-kyung.
Hello, Andrew.
What was the primary catalyst for the rally?
The Korean Confederation of Trade Union organized the strike to push prime contractors to engage in direct negotiations with subcontracted workers. The revised Trade Union and Labor Relations Adjustment Act, commonly known as the Yellow Envelope Act, took effect in March and legally pressures prime contractors to take responsibility as employers. But KCTU Chairman Yang Kyung-soo said that despite requesting negotiations with about 400 workplaces over the past 4 months, talks have actually begun at only four. The union's catchphrase is "Bring out the real boss." After the rally in central Seoul at 3 p.m., participants marched toward the presidential office of Cheongwade. Several affiliated unions also joined the action, with the Metal Workers Union holding partial strikes, the Care Workers Union suspending work for the day, and the Mart Workers Union holding a separate rally related to Home Plus. Rallies were also held in various other cities, and the KCTU estimated that around 100,000 took part around the nation.
In other headlines, President Lee Jae-myung began receiving policy briefings from government ministries and agencies on Wednesday. The briefings, following the first round held in December, began with economic-related ministries, including the Ministry of Economy and Finance, the Ministry of Budget and Planning, and the Financial Services Commission. The briefings will continue through early next month, with 9 sessions planned in total. What were some of the key points raised today?
Today, single-stock leveraged exchange-traded funds, so ETFs, was a key major talking point. Single-stock leveraged ETFs were introduced in May and tracking the daily performance of Samsung Electronics and SK Hynix. They have been blamed for amplifying the roller coaster swings on the Kospi. On Monday, the Kospi plunged nearly 9%, collapsing below 7,000 points for the first time in more than 2 months. It then edged up 0.73% on Tuesday, and then skyrocketed more than 6% on Wednesday. During today's briefings, Lee called for supplementary measures to address risks linked to the leveraged ETFs. Here's what he said.
The Korea exchange is also facing quite a stir over ETFs, isn't it? I urge you to promptly devise remedial measures. Please pay close attention to normalizing and advancing the capital market, as these are matters of great importance.
MSCI 선진국 지수 편입 문제는 이번에는 안 됐잖아요.
네. 네. We were not included in the MSCI developed market list. Our domestic stock market is quite unstable. We have experienced an unprecedented surge in a short period of time. It will take time and some volatility for the market to stabilize.
President Lee brought up the issue with Financial Supervisory Service Governor Lee Chan-jin, who said he accepts responsibility as a market regulator. The FSS chief previously said that he should have lain down in protest to block its introduction.
Turning to the Middle East, U.S. President Donald Trump has reversed his proposed 20% transit fee on all cargo passing through the Strait of Hormuz. What's the latest?
During an Oval Office meeting with Iraq's new prime minister on Tuesday, Trump said he changed his mind and decided to accept investment deals with Gulf states instead of fees. This is what he said.
So I put it out yesterday. I thought it was good. I was called by different people, different countries, kings and emirs and all of the people that we all know and we all love. And they've been, frankly, they've been very strong partners. And they said, we'd love to do it a different way. We'd love to invest in the United States with billions and billions of dollars and continue our record setting. You have Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar, Bahrain, and Kuwait, primarily, and then others.
Just a day earlier, Trump suggested that the U.S. collect a fee equivalent to 20% of the cargo's value in exchange for guarding ships in the Straits. The proposal briefly threatened severe economic shocks to energy-dependent nations like South Korea, which normally imports around 70% of its crude from the Middle East. Trump also told reporters that he doesn't think anyone should be able to charge a fee.
And how is the U.S. pressuring Iran to finalize a peace agreement?
The U.S. has officially reinstated its naval blockade on Iranian ports and continued its airstrikes for the fourth consecutive day on Tuesday. In an interview with Fox News, Trump also threatened to strike Iran's power plants and bridges unless the Iranians finalize their peace agreement by next week.
Back to domestic news. Prosecutors raided the Gwangju police headquarters Wednesday morning as part of an expanding probe into alleged police misconduct and cover-ups surrounding a very high-profile rape and murder case. What can you tell us, Inyo?
Chang Yoon-gi, the 23-year-old man accused of raping and fatally stabbing a 16-year-old female high school student in Gwangju, confessed to his crimes in court earlier this week. The case from last month sparked nationwide anger after prosecutors found allegations of a police cover-up involving Chang's father, who was a police captain in the city. The father is now in the prosecution's custody after allegedly destroying his son's phones and tampering with other evidence critical in investigating the case. The chief case officer and other police officials are being closely investigated over suspicions regarding the initial decision to classify the case as second-degree murder when forwarding it to the prosecution. After cross-verifying records, dashcam footage, and discovering evidence Chang's father sought to destroy, the prosecution upgraded the charge to first-degree rape murder.
The case has sparked a major political debate in South Korea regarding prosecutorial oversight and the separation of investigative powers. In-young, can you explain?
Sure. Some argue that without the prosecution's ability to conduct supplementary investigations, critical evidence of police cover-ups and misconduct could be permanently buried. The ruling Democratic Party has leveraged its overwhelming parliamentary majority to push through major legislative changes, driving President Lee's signature campaign to strip the prosecution of investigative powers. In the final stage of the DP-led prosecutorial reform, the ruling and opposition parties were at odds over whether the prosecution should retain the right to supplementary investigations. Now the ruling party itself is divided over the issue amid the controversy.
In economic news, labor groups, the business community, and public interest representatives have agreed to set next year's minimum wage at 10,700 won, or around $7.20 per hour, up 3.7% from this year. How did they reach the number?
Earlier, the country's two umbrella unions demanded a 16.3% increase from this year to 12,000 won per hour. The business side called for a freeze at 10,320 won per hour. They narrowed the difference to 130 won following multiple rounds of adjustments. Last night, the 27 commission members voted on 10,700 won put forth by businesses and 10,730 won proposed by the unions. And the public interest representative sided with the businesses.
And what are the unions and businesses saying about the new minimum wage?
Neither side is happy. Federation of Korean Trade Unions General Secretary Yoo Gi-sop said the rate increase failed to keep pace with inflation. Yoo Gi-jung, executive director at the Korea Enterprises Federation, said small business owners were struggling to stay afloat.
The Ministry of Defense is reportedly considering a plan to establish a unified military academy that will integrate the Army, Navy, and Air Force academies into a single four-year institution in the central city of Daejeon. In-young, tell us more, please.
Sure. According to military sources on Wednesday, the ministry is reviewing a plan to establish the Integrated Military Academy at Jaonde, a compound of military education and training facilities in Daejeon's Yuseong district. Under the proposal, cadets would undergo 4 years of integrated education at the new academy while receiving service-specific training in their final years to strengthen expertise in their respective branches. Jaonde is home to major military education institutions, including the Army College, Naval College, Air Force College, and the Joint Forces Military University. The initiative to establish an Armed Forces Academy is one of President Lee Jae-myung's campaign pledges, and the administration is accelerating the integration process, citing the need to enhance joint operational capabilities and prepare for future warfare. But concerns are being raised both within and outside the military that the move could undermine the specialized expertise and distinct identities of each service branch, ultimately weakening national defense capabilities. The ministry is expected to announce the plan to establish the new academy as early as Thursday.
We'll be talking more about this in our in-depth news analysis segment, but that's it for today's news briefing. Thank you, Inyoung.
Thank you, Andrew.
A debate is unfolding here in South Korea as the government seeks to merge the existing Army, Navy, and Air Force academies into one unified Armed Forces Military Academy. The initiative is one of President Lee Jae-myung's campaign pledges, and his administration is accelerating the integration process, citing the need to enhance joint operational capabilities and prepare for future warfare. However, concerns are being raised, both within and outside the military, that the move could undermine the specialized expertise and distinct identities of each service branch, ultimately weakening national defense capabilities. To delve into the topic, we have two distinguished guests joining us on the line. First, we have Chun Im-bum, a retired South Korean Army Lieutenant General, and now a military analyst. Hello, sir.
Hello, good morning.
Great to have you here on the show. We also have reporter Park Chun-ha, who specializes in offering analysis of domestic politics for Korea Pro. Hello, Mr. Park.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Let's start by going over the details of this proposed government plan. The Ministry of Defense is reportedly reviewing a plan to establish the Integrated Military Academy at Jaonde. It is a compound of military education and training facilities in Daejeon, and specifically the Yuseong district in Daejeon. The ministry is expected to announce the plan to establish the new academy as early as Thursday. Mr. Park, could you give our listeners a rundown of the details regarding the government's plan to integrate the nation's military academies into a single institution? And what does the plan exactly entail? And finally, what is the government trying to achieve with all of this?
Right. So I'll first go into what their central argument is. So their central argument is that South Korea's military education system, it no longer reflects the realities of modern warfare. So traditionally, the Army, Navy, Air Force have trained officers separately because each service fought largely in its own domain. But the defense ministry argues that today's conflicts from Ukraine to the Middle East, they do show that warfare is increasingly joint by nature. Drones, satellites, cyber operations, you know, artificial intelligence, what have you, all operating simultaneously across land, sea, air, and even space. So both President Lee Jae-myung and Defense Minister An Kyu-baek have therefore argued that officers should learn to think and operate jointly from the very beginning of their careers, rather than waiting until they become senior officers to receive joint service education. So as for what the reform will actually look like, that's still evolving. So earlier proposals, they envisioned a 2+2 model where it was suggested where cadets would complete 2 years of common education at a combined academy before transferring to their respective service academies for specialized training. However, as you've just mentioned, the latest report suggests that the Defense Ministry is leaning towards a fully integrated 4-year, what they call the National Armed Forces Academy, the 국군 사관학교, based in Daejeon's Jaonde Military Complex, with cadets studying together throughout their education while receiving service-specific practical training during their later years, so right before graduation or commissioning. So the ministry is also reportedly considering a longer-term plan. They're trying to expand the institution into a comprehensive military university. They're trying to incorporate other defense education institutions, including the Nursing Academy and also the Defense Advanced Technology Academy. So one important point right now is that the government has yet to release the detailed blueprint for how this reform will actually be implemented and how it will be discussed. They originally planned to unveil the proposal last week, but it was abruptly cancelled for scheduling changes. Now they are expected to do as early as this Thursday, and until then, much of the discussion that goes around this expected merger can only be detailed or based upon Minister Ahn's previous remarks, what the reports that have come out, and the recommendations that have been made earlier this year by a reform planning committee to the Defense Ministry.
It sounds like a pretty straightforward argument, but obviously there's a lot of noise and opposition to this plan. General Jun, you've spent several decades in the Army, first as a junior officer and, of course, later as a senior officer, overseeing thousands of men and women in uniform. We would love to think or listen to your initial thoughts when you first heard about this merger plan.
Yes, thank you. So I've been advocating for jointness for over 40 years of my life, 30 years of that in uniform, because I really believe that jointness is important. But another reason that the ministry has cited is the unnecessary rivalry between the Army, Navy, and Air Force, not to mention within the Army itself, between the Korea Military Academy graduates and other sources of commissioned officers. This is something that we absolutely do not need. So for these reasons, I have been advocating for a more integrated system. The problem with the current proposal is that I don't see a clear blueprint. All the things that the ministry is saying that they want to achieve is quite clear, but I don't see why they can't do it with a better curriculum. And the most concerning aspect of this is that they're trying to move the Korea Military Academy, the Army portion, from its present location in Taenong, Seoul, to some other location in Seoul. And I think this will be detrimental to not only Army morale, but the identity of the Republic of Korean government. So I'm very concerned about these two main issues.
The Alumni Associations of South Korea's Army, which you are a member of, and of course the Navy and the Air Force Academies as well, held a rally last week to express opposition to this merger, arguing that it could affect the military's history, traditions, identity, expertise, and national security. General, could you tell us more about their concerns?
Yes, the associations have a very long list of concerns, but I'm not going to mention all of them. But I'm going to mention just the top three. Number one is the lack of recognition of how important identity is. Now, jointness is important, but identity is equally important. And the lack of historical recognition of each service. Now, as Mr. Park has said, if they're going to create a national defense university where they're going to put all of them in there for 4 years instead of the initial 2+2 model, this issue becomes, I think, more critical. The second thing is that the association believes that jointness can be created after the officers become majors or above, field grades. This is an argument that I personally don't agree with, but that's what they're saying. Finally, the concerns of the association is that they were not consulted. And that even at this current situation that we are in, that they have not been allowed to have a place or an opportunity to have their concerns reflected in the final decision. So those are the main concerns.
The concerns sound legitimate and worth a look. And the fact that the associations feel that they were not consulted suggests that there might have been a lack of communication about this proposed policy. But the government has been citing declining competition for admission and falling admission scores at the military academies. That is usually high school seniors or 19-year-olds who are applying to positions in these academies as a reason that the academies should be merged. Defense Minister An Yubek said the scale of the military academies must be expanded to create a larger vessel for nurturing national talent. He also added that the integrated institution will provide a platform for cadets to build capabilities in advanced fields like artificial intelligence. Sir, what do you think are the causes of the declining competition for admission and the falling admission scores at the military academies, and what measures could be taken to address these issues?
You know, this is another misconception of the facts. Yes, it seems the scores for entering the academy has gone down somewhat. But we're not trying to raise doctors or scientists here. We're trying to raise leaders. Leadership does not come by scores of a Sunung test. Even now, if you meet these cadets, they're very, very smart. And they're all-round persons. They're pretty good at math. They're pretty good at English. They're pretty good at, you know, athletics. So to say that their quality has gone down, or to imply that, is an insult to these young men and women. Again, if they were to move especially the Korean Military Academy in Seoul from the outer regions, every Korean knows that if you do that, there's a word called insole, which means all the young kids want to come to a university in Seoul boundary. Do you think this will really attract good students if they move it to a region outside of Seoul? So again, it doesn't make sense. If I were the ministry, I would put in a plan like, you know, the cadets live all together, you know, in a tight community. They endure a lot of studying. Why can't we give them, instead of just a bachelor's degree within 3 years, and then one year of intensive study to give them a master's degree? That's what other academies do. That kind of incentive is needed. Finally, the main reason that the Army and the Navy and the Air Force is losing its attraction is because Korean politicians humiliate people in uniform. Hmm. You know, the politicians should think before they do that. And if you want to, you know, put bad military people on TV, put them on TV without their uniforms. That's what I would suggest.
So General Jun, pointing out the possibility that moving the academy out of Seoul might actually worsen the problem that the government has cited, or the reason that it has cited for moving the academy possibly to another part of Seoul, or maybe now to part of Daejeon. Mr. Park, what has the government and supporters of the merger plans, that is the opposite side of this national debate, what have they said about the criticisms raised by General Jun and other members or former alumni of the academies?
Well, I think from what I've observed, what's worth emphasizing is that the ruling Democratic Party has also been quite relatively quiet on the details of the proposal. But looking at the arguments made by Defense Minister An Yubek and also several experts who had advised on or publicly supported the reform, there are quite a few consistent themes that we can come up with. Of course, as we've mentioned before, they argue that the current academy system no longer reflects the realities of modern warfare. Second, supporters, they reject the argument that integration would necessarily weaken this sort of service-specific expertise. So Choi Young-jin, a professor at Chungang University who chaired the Military Academy Reform Committee, under the advisory panel that designed the 2x2 proposal or 2+2 proposal, which has now been sort of U-turned on. He argued that most cadets already spend their first 2 years taking broadly similar foundational and liberal arts courses. So in his view, meaningful specialization largely occurs later, so during the third or fourth year. So from that perspective, a common educational foundation would not eliminate expertise, but simply shift when or how it is developed. So there's also an efficiency argument that he carries. So instead of maintaining separate academic curricula, administrative organizations and facilities across three academies, the government believes that it can consolidate common education, redirect savings towards emerging fields such as AI, autonomous systems, cyber warfare, space operations, whatnot. So, and then also there's others who give a bit more of a nuanced view, such as Mr. Son Am-yeol. He's a former Korea Military Academy graduate and also now head of the Korea Defense and Security Forum. He stresses that integration alone, it won't be enough. So he argued that reform must also improve facilities, faculty, officer careers, and living conditions if it is to attract top talent and succeed in the long run. So overall, the government supporters frame the merger less as an effort to erase the identities of the individual services and further worsening the sort of cohesion between the military, but more as a long-term modernization of South Korea's officer education system, making the military better prepared for increasingly joint technologically driven joint warfare.
The questions that I think policymakers have been trying to answer are very complicated and impossible to answer with certainty, just because of the fact that we can't test this, test the various hypotheses being posed by both camps of this debate. But I guess we have to ask the question, are there other countries that have been doing this? Mr. Park, could you perhaps mention some examples of other countries having merged their academies into one single institution?
Right. So, yes, there are other countries that have merged Army, Navy, and Air Force academies, but there isn't a single international model. So different countries have taken different approaches depending on the size of the military and their operational needs. So countries like Japan, Australia, and Canada, they educate future Army, Navy, and Air Force officers together before they move on to service-specific training after graduation. That's broadly the type of model Seoul is considering, where cadets build a common foundation first and specialize later. However, some experts, they do caution that those examples aren't directly comparable to South Korea. Japan's self-defense forces operate under a unique constitutional framework. Australia and Canada, they have relatively smaller militaries than South Korea, where consolidation offers greater efficiency for them. So many larger militaries at the moment, they continue to do the opposite. So the United States, for example, which South Korea has seen as a benchmark for its own military in multiple cases, it maintains separate academies, the West Point, the Naval Academy, the Air Force Academy, to name a few, and develops jointness later through joint professional military education and joint assignments after graduation. So the United Kingdom, France, they also continue to educate officers through separate service academies like the British Army's Sandhurst and also France's Saint-Cyr. So international practice offers only qualified support for Seoul's proposal at the moment, or what is expected to be Seoul's proposal. So integrated academies, they certainly exist, but they're more common among these relatively smaller militaries. So the larger militaries that South Korea often looks to as reference models, they generally preserve separate service academies while emphasizing joint operations later in officers' careers. That's something that South Korea will have to consider if it chooses to move forward with its blueprint.
General Jun, Mr. Park has nicely summarized the potential routes that the country can take. What do you think of all these international examples, and what do you think is the best possible route that the South Korean military can take?
So Mr. Park has given good explanations of the proponents of the integration, as well as the pros and cons of a integrated system that other countries have. And it's true that it saves cost. And to an economist, it's more efficient. And it has elements where jointness can be and might be enhanced. But of these all elements, creating jointness is the key. Now, we, besides what Mr. Park has mentioned, are in a different situation. Namely, we have a real enemy, and North Korea is getting better day by day. So one thing is economics should not come before security issues. If you want to save money, you know, do it somewhere else. Security should not be something of a test bed. As of now, I am still not convinced or do not understand the blueprint that the Ministry of National Defense has. They've come up with a great goal, but the solution that they're presenting does not give me a good feeling or a comfortable understanding of what they're trying to do. And so even I, who have been advocating for more jointness and to a degree integration, are critical of what's going on right now.
Mr. Park, as a final thought, what issues should we watch out for from here on out?
So the immediate thing to watch is, of course, the government's blueprint itself and how it announces it. The Defense Ministry is reportedly expected to unveil its basic plan by the end of this week at the latest, which should finally answer some of the key questions that have remained unresolved, including whether the government would pursue a full four-year integrated academy or a phased model. So after that, the bigger challenge will be implementation rather than policy. You know, establishing a new National Armed Forces Academy or whatever they choose to call it would require significant funding for new facilities, transition plan for current cadets, enough lead time for prospective applicants. So the government also plans to introduce special legislation because the current legal framework treats the Army, Navy, and Air Force academies as separate institutions. I think for me, perhaps the biggest hurdle that the Defense Ministry and also the public needs to watch out for is for the Defense Ministry to build public and institutional consensus. Right now, as the general has mentioned, there has been not really a culminating consensus on whether South Korea should move forward with the merger this early on. Supporters, they do argue that joint education is essential for the future battlefield, as we've mentioned. While the opponents, they do worry about weakening each service's identity, professional expertise, and also economy over readiness. So there is also likely to be resistance from these alumni groups or continued resistance and also local communities, particularly if the reforms involve relocating existing academies to a different region further south. So even if the government announces an ambitious blueprint this week, that's really just the beginning. The success of the reform will ultimately depend on whether the ministry can convince both the military and the public that the benefits outweigh the costs and successfully translate the proposal into legislation and implementation. This is one of the largest overhauls for South Korea's military academic infrastructure in decades. So the Lee administration will have to look and look further.
And possibly the century, I should say. That was Park Jun-ha from Korea Pro. Thank you for your time and expertise today. Thank you, Mr. Park.
Thank you very much.
And we also had retired Lieutenant General Chun In-bum. Thank you for your time and expertise as well today, sir.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index spiked 427.58 points or 6.24% on Wednesday to close at 7,284.41. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ gained 45.45 points or 5.8% to close at 829.43. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets, handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello. Hello there, Andrew.
And what's our first story?
Well, Norway has been eliminated in the quarterfinals of the 2026 FIFA World Cup. The team's biggest star continues to make headlines. People around the world adore Erling Haaland as he is an amazing scorer and a charismatic yet fun-loving character. But among Korean fans, the biggest talking point is the hair tie he uses.
I praise Erling Haaland's ability to able to have his man bun and ponytail. I think it looks good on him, but why is his hair tie a talking point here in Korea?
First of all, on Haaland's signature hairstyle, some call it the Erling knot, a tight, slicked-back ponytail that he loops halfway through on the last pull. This stops the end from hitting his back while keeping his hair completely out of his face. And the hair tie plays a crucial role, of course. The brand is named Kuneki, a very familiar-sounding name to Koreans. It led to people going online, digging deeper to find out if there's a connection, and that word is actually a dialect word for string or cord in the Gyeongsang provinces.
So it's a saturi, or an accent version of that word. But it's interesting that a product sold in Norway uses such term, a very obscure Korean term, that is. Tell us more about the product.
The product was created by a Korean manufacturer founded in 1987 in Hamyang, South Gyeongsang Province, with various online comments pointing out how some Koreans who used the brand back then remembered how excellent the product quality was and the distinctive name. It was acquired by a Norwegian accessories brand in 2015. The company reportedly kept the name for the particular hair tie product, loved by the soccer superstar, as a nod to the region where it all began.
And why does Haaland love his tie so much?
Well, during the ongoing World Cup, Haaland's trademark hairstyle has become one of the tournament's biggest talking points. Viewers marvel at how it remains perfectly in place through 90 minutes of sprinting aerial duels and celebrations. The company continues to use a distinctive weaving technique designed to make the ties both durable and gentle on the hair. Haaland shows a lot of love for the products, posting photos of him color-coordinating hair ties with outfits and holding up a ridiculous number of the hair ties as well. His love for the product goes beyond just remaining a loyal customer. After swearing by it for years, he even became a minority shareholder of the company in 2024.
I think his hair looks great, but I didn't know the backstory of how it's kept in place during his games. But let's now move on to our next story. What do you have, Dan?
The National Museum of Korea broke the annual visitor record in just the first 6 months of the year.
The National Museum here has been growing in popularity, of course, but give us the details. How big of a record are we talking about?
So according to data released on Wednesday, the museum broke the record by drawing over 3.79 million visitors by June 2026. The previous record set in 2025 was slightly over 3.78 million, and that took the whole year.
Great to hear the museum is doing well, but let's dive a little deeper into the numbers, please.
The most noteworthy figure is the number of foreign visitors, a significant spike, up 68.8% on year. There was especially high turnout centered around the Lunar New Year and May holidays. The museum continues to see turnout numbers not seen since first opening back in 1945. The Art newspaper, a British art publication, ranked the Korean Museum as the third most visited in the world after the Louvre in Paris and the Vatican Museums.
Those are some impressive names to be associated with. What has the National Museum here has been doing to harness this growth in popularity?
The National Museum of Korea plans to expand its opening hours by 30 minutes for the busy summer season. In response to growing global interest in K-culture, officials have been introducing various exhibits and displays that highlight various traditional Korean elements, including a recent one that revolves around Korean cuisine. The museum expects to receive a cumulative total of between 6 and even 7 million annual visitors by the end of this year.
Wishing even higher numbers for the National Museum of Korea, rooting for them, that is. But now to our final story, Dan. What do you have?
Retrieving a lost item typically meant visiting a lost and found center in person. So we have a new system in Seoul Subway, which is about to see a major upgrade. Items will be delivered right to one's doorstep.
Sounds like good news for people who may not be living in Seoul. How is the Seoul subway proposing to go about this?
Well, this is going to be done through a team up with CJ, a major local logistics firm. Seoul Metro packages the items and the logistics firm does the delivery. A lot of time constraints and inconveniences were involved, but under the new service, a customer who confirms with a lost and found center and completes ID verification can arrange delivery and pay the shipping fee online.
And the subway, I guess, is proposing to ship the materials to their owners.
Yes, they would. On Wednesday, the two sides signed a memorandum of understanding to collaborate and provide the lost and found item delivery service.
How many stuff are put in the lost and found in the Seoul subway?
So officials said that more than 160,000 items were reported lost in the subway just last year. Taking into consideration those who face difficulty visiting a lost and found center in person, such as people who live outside of Seoul, as you mentioned, the companies came up with a service to effectively remove constraints of time and distance. They plan to work together on customer inquiries, complaint handling, and service improvements to keep this program running smoothly.
Well, that sounds like a better and improved lost and found to me. But that's all we have for today's edition of Korea Trending. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's time now for Korea Book Club, our weekly segment where we dive into the world of Korean literature and books, exploring works either in Korean or English translations. Connecting with us today is Julia Ratti, a translator from Korean into Italian and English. Julia, hello and welcome back.
Hi, Andrew. It's been a while, and actually this is my first time meeting you, so nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. And where are you calling from?
Oh, I'm in Milan, Italy. I flew back home last week to spend some time with my family.
Must be nice to be back home, obviously. But what book will you be talking about today from Milan?
Well, after the break with Sonbom Issuel, which I introduced the last time I was on the show, today will mark a return to my favorite genre, which is horror. So today I want to talk about Kim Bo-hyun's Bloody Mother, which has been published by An Jung Ga-ok in 2024. And starting from the font used for the title in Hangul, we can already sort of glean something about this novel. The Ma of Mado can be read as both Ma or Mo. Like visually, it looks almost like a cross, which in turn means that the title can be both read as Bloody Mado or Bloody Modo, so mother or murder. And this wordplay is anything but casual, but it becomes clearer later on as we explore the book's plot and themes.
So it could be Bloody Mother or Bloody Murder, because the Korean font on the cover can, I guess, be read as both ways. I looked at the cover and I did wonder about the title, which I think can trigger a lot of questions. But is the book available only in Korean?
Oh, no. Actually, it's been translated into English and Italian. So I did the Italian translation, and my friend Archana Madhavan's English translation is set to come out in September. So I thought it would be fun to bring here to the Korea Book Club a novel that I did with my friend and colleague, you know, like sort of like did together, quote, with my friend. If there are any Italian readers listening in, my Italian translation already came out for Mercurio Books on April 10 with the title Sangue Madre, which means Mother Blood, another play on the book's themes. And then English readers will have to wait until September 1st to see it in bookstores with the title Mother Sucker, which again, it's a fun take, almost impertinent on the story.
So that's an S, not an F, for listeners who might be wondering what was going on there.
Yes.
I should first congratulate you, Julia. So congrats on the release.
Thank you. And
regarding the English title, I think I must say it's quite provocative. Again, it's Mother Sucker with an S, which, by the way, was mentioned in our book club segment last week by Jean Peng, who said she was looking forward to the English version's release. But should we start by talking about the author herself, Kim Bo-hyun?
Yes, gladly so. Kim Bo-hyun began her literary career with her short story Goni, which means swan, which was selected for Chaum and Mom's New Literature Award in 2011. She then received the award at the Korea Story Contest in 2013 for Owl Boy and 2015 for Penguin I Lie Dead. Since then, she has published three full-length novels, one in 2017 titled If Someone Calls My Name, then The Worst Thing in 2022, and finally Bloody Mother or Mothersucker in 2024. As a writer, she seems to take inspiration from the most relevant social issues, rendering her books even more visceral. An example is The Worst Thing, like in Korea, teen suicide is a real emergency, and Kim tackles this topic through the difficulties her main character experiences. First, the loss of her child, who ends his own life, and then her husband, who goes missing.
That sounds like a tough plot to read through, let alone write. What are some of the themes in Mothersucker?
So Mothersucker revolves around gender-based violence. It's composed of a vast cast of secondary characters, each a victim of bigotry and misogynist abuse of all kinds. It can be verbal, mental, or physical, that any woman anywhere in the world can at least recognize, if not even identify with. So in this sense, I've noticed that even if the reviews of my Italian translation were overall positive, a lot of readers were complaining about how hard it was to get through the book because it hit too close to home for comfort, despite the novel being on the short side. So now I'm really looking forward to seeing Anglophone readers' reactions.
So again, it's a tough theme to tackle, but why and how is this a horror book? From what you've been telling us so far, it sounds more like a crime novel or something along the lines of Kim Ji-young's Born 1982.
Well, in a way, you are correct, but also keep in mind that I was only explaining the themes of the book, while in reality, one of the main characters is a vampire.
I'm always amazed at how these writers weave in these strange characters. How does a vampire fit into the story?
So I'm going to start from the beginning. The book opens with the discovery of a dead man stuffed inside a storm drain. His body is charred, drained of blood, and kneeling in prayer. Police Inspector No Jin-sun immediately realizes that this is no ordinary murder. So with the help of a special task force, Jin-sun continues to investigate while the nation is shaken by a series of murders, all involving women of different ages and professions as the victims. The police quickly realizes that the only connection between the targets is that they're men who have hurt, humiliated, or destroyed the lives of women. The murderer, however, leaves behind no trace at all, almost as if it's a disembodied entity that defies time. And interspersed with Jin-sun chapters and the police investigation are those from female characters that recount various experiences of abuse. Kyung-shin, for example, endures months of dating violence and blackmail. Ji-hee is sexually assaulted. Yoo-jin is in a coma after being brutally beaten up by a college student simply for being gay. And then in other chapters, we get the perspective of a mother whose daughter Chongya was killed by her boyfriend. And after burying her daughter and seeing her get only 3 years of prison, Chongya's mother is reborn as a vampire, so a monster created by monsters, and is now looking for change. Affected by the passing of time, the vampire travels in the past and in the future, answering the calls of women who wish death on their tormentors.
So it sounds like a story featuring a lot of people who have been marginalized, a person being killed for simply being gay, a person being killed by her boyfriend, someone sexually assaulted. So these are tough stories that these characters have been through. But why do you think the author decided to add such a different character like a vampire to a story that is, again, fundamentally grounded in our very imperfect reality?
I think this is just my opinion, obviously, but I think the author's intention was to crank up the reader's suspension of disbelief to the maximum. So after all, as you said, the topic that she tackles isn't the easiest. Seeing these crimes in the news almost on a daily basis has numbed us to a certain point, but not entirely. So the novel's continuous switch of point of views and the discovery of the abuse endured by all these women generate in the reader a fury so devastating that it'd be difficult difficult to quell without a sort of like a release valve. So that's where the fantasy element of the vampire comes in, together with the ending, when a community of women forms to give voice to their experiences. The vampire and the community serve as a cool down moment of sorts, a way to soothe the feminine rage contained in and inflamed by the previous chapters, and to elevate it to something atemporal, like outside of time. Seeing on the page the revenge taken against a judicial system that doesn't protect and instead sweeps under the rug gender-based crimes feels refreshing, especially if you are a woman or a minority, exactly like what you said earlier. So it's an uncomfortable truth, but this book exists to talk about it, to bring it to the fore. I just suspend the space, like brutal but necessary, where morality cannot exist.
I would agree with your point on the justice system often falling short in terms of adequately protecting victims. To wrap things up, though, what attracted you to this book and who do you think it's for?
So personally, I wanted to work on it because I believe it adds a powerful voice to the cause against the epidemic of violence against women. Anyone who shares my perspective will probably find this book engaging, despite like a little bit of a trigger warning for the topics and the kind of violence that is described. And finally, I think this readership also basically overlaps with that of Molka and The Eyes Are the Best Part by Monica Kim.
Molka was, of course, the book that Jean Peng talked about last week. But the book we talked about, so the themes do overlap, as you just said. But again, the book we talked about today was Mother Sucker with an S by Kim Boyun, introduced to us by Julia Ratti, who happens to be the translator of the Italian version of the book, again, Sangue Madre. Julia, thank you for introducing us to this very scary book.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
And this is where we wrap up today's show. Again, you can always listen to Korea 24 on various apps, KBS Kong, KBS World Radio, and KBS World Radio on air at 7:10 p.m. Korea Standard Time every weekday. We'll be back tomorrow. I've been your host, Andrew Jung. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
What you're about to hear could save a life. These are step-by-step instructions for performing CPR, or cardiopulmonary resuscitation, a life-saving emergency procedure used when a person's heart is not functioning properly. First, if someone collapses and is unresponsive, ensure the scene is safe. Tap the patient's shoulder and shout, "Are you okay?" If the person remains unresponsive, if their breathing is abnormal, or if there are any signs of a seizure, immediately call 119 or your local emergency number or point out someone nearby to make the call. The faster you call, the better. You can also make a video call or send photos to the local emergency number. Start CPR immediately, rather than leaving the scene to find someone else for help or looking for a pulse. Place the heel of your dominant hand in the center of the person's chest. Place your other hand on top, keep your arms straight, and press hard and fast. Press hard and fast at a rate of 100 to 120 compressions per minute. That's the beat of Staying Alive playing right now. Push in at least 2 inches or 5 centimeters and allow the chest to rise fully between compressions. If you are not trained and are not confident in rescue breathing, continue hands-only CPR until emergency medical personnel arrive. Immediate CPR can help maintain blood flow to the brain and vital organs. Acting quickly may save a life. This has been a public safety message on CPR. KBS World Radio is committed to keeping our listeners informed and prepared, because knowing what to do in an emergency makes all the difference. Stay safe, stay informed.
KBS World Radio.